had hoped to demonstrate how self-esteem can be enhanced through Jewish living. And here I do have to repeat what I said earlier today, and that is that I have found clinically that an enormous number of people's problems in adjusting to life situations, and many of the problems that ends up bringing them into the professional office of the psychotherapist of whatever breed, is a result of the fact that so many, many people have a chronic self-underestimation and are not aware of their own strengths. And the purpose of psychotherapy in those situations is very simply to help an individual discover the truth about himself or herself. Because as we become aware of the strengths that we really have, we are so much more capable of coping with life situations. Let me give you a very simple example, a true-to-life situation. A number of years ago, I had to do one of the unpleasant tasks of reality, and that is to pay the monthly bills. And I sat down with a pile of bills and a checkbook, added up, and I found out that I had some $900 plus of bills to send out. And then I went back and calculated the checkbook stubs to be able to see what my balance is in the bank, and I was horrified to discover that I had $62 in the bank. Now, I knew that there had to be a mistake because there was no reason on earth why I should be that low. So I took the calculator and went back and rechecked it carefully and came up with the answer, $62. That was a very unpleasant situation. Furthermore, I could not begin to understand why this happened. I had not made any great expenditures. There was no reason why I should be broke. But you cannot deny facts, you know. The numbers were there, it said 62, not 962, it had 62, and there was simply no way that I was going to be able to pay those bills. I did not want to take out another loan, I had enough already. And I came to the unpleasant decision that I'm not going to pay my bills this month, it's going to wait for another month. And I don't like to do that. It's very distasteful to get bills in the mail and open them up and say, past due, second notice, and all of those implied threats. But there was no choice. I can tell you that for the next 2 weeks, I went around extremely irritable. Irritable, angry, I'm not sure who I was angry at. There wasn't anybody specific to be angry at, but I was terribly upset. Probably had you met me on the street and had you say, how are you? I would have told you none of your business. I mean, it was that kind of mood, you know. And then, after about 2 weeks, we hit the first of the next month. And in the mail came the monthly bank statement. And as I opened up the bank statement, I realized that I had quite a healthy balance in the bank. And I was not broke. That was strange. So I went back and checked things out, and I discovered what had happened. About 2 months before this incident, the hospital where I was working had offered us direct deposit, meaning that instead of our receiving the check and having to deposit it, they would deposit it directly to our account in the bank, which was fine. It saved me a trip to the bank. Now, when I made the deposit myself, as soon as I made the deposit, I took out the checkbook and wrote in the amount of the deposit. Since I was no longer making the deposit, I had to remember that on payday, you know, make sure that you enter the amount of the deposit. But I had forgotten once. So, the reality was that I had adequate amount of money to pay my bills. Yet I was walking around terribly upset with everyone and everything, angry at the whole world. Because why? Because I didn't feel that I could cope with reality. The reality was that they demanded money, my creditors were demanding money, and I couldn't cope with it. I didn't know what to cope with it with. And so I was terribly upset. Now what did I need? Did I need a loan? No. Did I need charity? Of course not. What I needed was for the bank to tap me on the shoulder, right, and say, hey, look, stupid, you know, what's your problem? You know, you've got the money in the bank, it's yours to spend it. So all I needed to be made aware of what was the real reality. Not the reality that I imagined, but the real reality was that I had the funds I needed. That has its counterpart in all of our lives. Maybe not so much with the bank account, but in our own personality strengths. Many people escape out of life situations or make improper adjustments simply because they are unaware of what it is they have to cope with. Believe me, many of us are chronic self-underestimators. Why this is so is another issue. We may or may not get to it, but that's not important. Wherever it came from is nowhere near as important as to get over it. And in many situations, I feel that that is the job of the therapist. Not to give the individual anything new, but to help him or her find out what it is that they already have that they don't know of. There are various ways in which we can talk about the symptoms that, the manifest symptoms that we have. And again, I don't even want to tell you where our time is limited. Let me just tell you that there are many, many symptoms as a result of social isolation, withdrawing ourselves from people, fear of intimate relationships, of attempts at perfectionism, people-pleasing activities, trying to make everybody like you because you don't believe you can be liked. And there's a precipitating rejection, just a whole host of kinds of things that happen in all of our lives, unnecessarily. One of the beautiful stories that has come down through Hasidic channels is somewhat along this line. And it shows us a little bit about what they understood about people underestimating themselves. They tell a story that one of the followers of the great Maggid of Meserich, who was a disciple of the Baal Shem, came and asked his advice because he was having a terrible time being able to concentrate on his davening and on his study of Torah because of intrusive thoughts that he couldn't keep out of his head. And at times when he wanted to daven, these thoughts would come in and then just totally distract him and irritate him. So he came to the Maggid and he said, "What do I do with this? You know, I've tried to keep these thoughts out of my mind. I can't." So the Maggid said, sent him to Zhytomyr, city in Ukraine, where Reb Wolf, who was one of the disciples of the Maggid, lived. And he said, "You go ask Reb Wolf to help you." Maggid said to go to Reb Wolf, so he went to Zhytomyr, found out where Reb Wolf lived, and came to the house. Toward evening, he knocked on the door, no answer. Knocked again, no answer. Kept on knocking, no answer. Went around and knocked at the back door, no answer. Knocked at all the shutters, no answer. Well, he reasoned Reb Wolf was not home. He finally gave up, sat down in the doorway to wait for him. Got late at night, he's sitting in the doorway, he fell asleep. He slept there all night. Toward morning, the door opens, and Reb Wolf is there, and Reb Wolf asks him to come in the house. And he says to him, "Nu, younger man, did you learn anything?" He looks at him, "No, what's he supposed to learn?" So he says, "I wanted to demonstrate to you that in my home I am the master. And if you want to get in, no matter how hard you try, I don't have to let you in. I'm boss of the house." And of course the answer was this idea of, I can't keep thoughts out of my mind. It's just a unnecessary resignation. Sure you can. You've got the ability to do it. The idea of I can't is resigning yourself and surrendering with a mistaken self-estimation that you can't possibly be master. Now, of course, that is a kind of status that may be beyond us. It wasn't beyond the students of the Maggid. But there are many ways similarly in which we resign ourselves and we assume, we abdicate our capabilities abdicate our responsibilities sometimes because we're unaware of our potential. And so almost everything that I've written, whether it's from a kind of ethics-oriented book like Let Us Make Man, or the kind of thing that I wrote about the stories that were handed down the family, which we enjoyed today, by Shalashidis, or all the way down to Charlie Brown. I would hope that many people are fans of Charlie Brown just like I am. And our neighbor up here to the north, Mr. Schultz, who draws Charlie Brown, is a fantastically insightful psychologist. And if you're at all aware of Charlie Brown is a young child who fails at everything he does. But for only one reason, because he believes he's going to fail. Charlie Brown fulfills a self-prophecy. And many people do that. And in one way or another, many of us do that. So almost everything that I've written about has been, again, approaching the theme from one side or another, the business of self-esteem. There are some beautiful stories in generation to generation where I talk about my family experiences, which, again, I thought I was writing a story, an anthology of family stories, and ended up being a book on self-esteem. With sometimes some strange ideas of what we do because of an inadequate self-esteem. Like some people that we know will try to manifest their adequacy and prove to the rest of the world how okay they really are. Now, why do you have to prove anything which is self-evident? You know, you feel good about yourself, you don't have to prove anything to anyone. Once we set out to prove things to people, isn't it self an indication that I feel inadequate, I feel insecure about it, and I better make certain that everybody knows how okay I really am. One of the stories that I mentioned up there is a story you may be familiar with. It's one of the beautiful stories of the wise men of Chelm. You know, we have a rich heritage in Jewish folklore as well. And you remember the stories of the wise men of Chelm. Some are simply entertaining, amusing stories, but others are fantastically, fantastically insightful. And I always tell this one to a group of psychologists when they talk about achieving an identity, having a feeling of who am I. And the story that I tell is of one of the Chelmites who went to the public bathhouse and became panic-stricken because, with everybody bathing, of course, being without clothes, he said, well, if everybody's without clothes, then we all look alike. Well, then, when it comes time to go home, how am I going to know which one is me? Now, which is, of course, a very serious problem for a Chelmite. So he gave it some thought, and he came up with a very brilliant idea, as only a Chelmite could do. Found a piece of red string, and he tied it around his toe. So now I know which one I am. Unfortunately, in the process of showering and bathing and sudsing and lathering, whatever, the red string unraveled, it fell off. However, it happened to be in such a position that another one of the bathers, when he happened to step on it, it stuck to his foot. Well, later on, this first Chelmite comes and he meets this other fella, and he sees that he's got a red string on his foot. So he quickly looks down at his own foot and he sees nothing. So he goes over to the second man and he taps him on the shoulder and he says, pardon me, I know who you are, but can you tell me who am I? You see, when people have no self-esteem and they begin looking for ways to get a feeling as to who they are, they do things that are very similar to Chelmites, except we don't think it as silly because it's culturally accepted. You know who I am? I am the one with the Mercedes in my driveway. Or I am the one with the marble stairs leading to my home. Now, what I'd like to know is what happens when you sell the Mercedes to somebody else. Does he become you? Yeah. What happens if you sell the house? Does your own title as well as the title of the house go over to? See, that's what happens when our identity is in red strings or in Mercedes or in anything else. If my identity is in my profession, then I'm not really me. Right? I'm just part of a profession, but I have no individual identity. So there's many ways of looking at the problem of self-esteem. And in some of the writings, you'll see that I've addressed the problem and from various aspects. But more than all else, the question is what to do about it. Which is the question that people always say, okay, you're great at giving problems, now start providing solutions. There are no easy solutions to it. By the time we come around to becoming aware of a problem of self-esteem, by that time we're already 20 or 25 or 30 or more, and we've already had the problem ever since we were age 3 or 4. Because that's probably when it begins. And then we just continue to enlarge upon it. One of the ways in which we can get a better hold on it is through a thorough understanding of Torah, a thorough understanding of Jewishness. Let's first take a look at the very phrase that we chose for this lecture. Let us make man. Where does that come from? It comes from the Torah, where the Torah says that after the first 5 days plus of creation, and Hashem had created everything, then Hashem said, let us make man. Now that posed a problem to many commentaries, because inasmuch as Hashem was doing everything himself, and everywhere else throughout creation, Hashem said, and Hashem did, and Hashem made, all in the singular, and all of a sudden, let us make man. Plural. Who's the us? So Rashi, one of the leading commentaries, said that Hashem had gathered a council of angels to ask their opinion. Not that he needed their opinion. God doesn't need anybody's input. But he did this in order to teach human beings humility. That even though you may be as omnipotent, as an omniscient, as all-wise as God, you nevertheless should ask counsel from those beneath you. And if God can ask for counsel, so can you. Okay, very good point. I never was quite satisfied with that, even though this is the meaning that Rashi says. And I've been looking for other meanings. And then I came across with began to think a little bit about, having created all other living things, God now moves on to the creation, to the ultimate creation, man. What is this unique creature, man, that God is creating? Now, when I went to high school, and I took my biology courses, they taught me what the definition of man was. And they said man was... They said that man was Homo sapiens. That's what I learned. Remember that? Homo sapiens. Now, if we break that down into English, what that means is that Homo refers to a group of animals, hominoids, that includes chimpanzees and orangutans and monkeys and gorillas and apes and all the rest. And man is part of that larger group scientifically. But what makes him unique and separates him from that group is sapience. Intellect. Man is the only animal of that group that has intellect. That is Homo sapiens. I didn't think of it at the time when I was in high school. Later on I began thinking about it, that biology is telling me that I am a gorilla with intellect. Well, somehow or other, my self-esteem rejected that, right? I will not argue that intellect is one of the unique features of man, but it is not the only unique feature of man. Now, the Torah tells us that Vayipach Be'apov Nishmas Ruachayim, that man was created as a lifeless form, and then Hashem breathed a soul of life into him. Now, we're not going to go into the more esoteric and more profound meanings, although they are certainly absolutely true, where Hasidus teaches us that if one breathes into someone else or into something else, one breathes out of himself into something else. And that, in other words, Hashem was putting part of himself into every human being. But let's not go into that meaning. Let's simply take a look that Hashem put into the being a spirit. A ruach chaim. Ve'yipach ba'achbav nishmas ruach chaim. And this ruach chaim, this spirit, is what is unique to man. Hashem didn't do this with others, with other creatures. So let's take a look then, in what way is man unique? Because one of the things that we talked about earlier today was that unless you fulfill that which you are supposed to be, you'll never have any self-esteem. If you buy a little scooter that runs on 6 horsepower, and it delivers the full 6 horsepower that it is capable of doing, then it is a good scooter and it's doing its job well. And if you buy a super souped up automobile that has a V8 cylinder engine and is capable of producing 400 horsepower, but 2 of its 8 cylinders are not operating well, and it is producing only 240 horsepower, it's still producing 40 times as much horsepower as the little scooter. But whereas the scooter is going to go along smoothly, this car is going to give you a very choppy ride. Why? After all, it's got 240 horsepower. Yes, but it was designed to work on 400. It was designed to work on all 8 cylinders. And if not all 8 cylinders are operating, it's going to give you a rough, choppy ride. The little motor scooter with 6 horsepower, since it's doing all that it can, will give you a smooth, slow ride, but smooth. Right? The 240 horsepower is going to give you a rough ride because it was capable of 400. Which means that if we are capable of 400 horsepower and we're only operating at 350, right, our life is not going to be smooth. We're going to have problems. Whatever it is that we are capable of doing, right, that is the potential to which we have to try to reach. And if we settle for any less than that, our course in life is going to be choppy. So let us take a look, what is this ruach that man has that animal doesn't have? Now probably you can help me come up with features that you can recognize that are unique to man. I recognize one of the things that are unique to man, yes, intelligence. Intellect is different in animals than in man, right? Another thing that is unique, I think, to man is that man is capable of learning from history. Animals do not learn from history. We are told that Alexander had a horse, Bucephalus. Excellent horse. Well, I wonder if the grandson of Bucephalus ever thought, my grandfather was such a marvelous horse. I wonder what I can do to achieve his greatness. Or if a racehorse that lost a race and sired another horse, whether that horse would ever say, now, my father made this race and he made a mistake when he went around the bend, and I'm going to improve on that mistake. Right? As, you know, animals don't learn from history. So there we have one unique feature that is part of man that is different than animal. We can have the capacity to learn from history. I really don't believe that it ever has happened that an alligator has said, I wonder if I'm as good an alligator as I can be. Maybe I could be more of an alligator than I am. No, I can't swear that an alligator never thought that. I just don't think it happens. Which means that the idea of self-improvement is another feature that is unique to man. I don't believe that any animal has ever thought, wonder what's the purpose of my existence? You know, a cow comes out and eats grass and eats hay and goes back and gives milk and does ever think, what was I created for? And is there anything more to my existence than eating and sleeping? I don't believe that cows do that. I can't swear that they don't, but I just don't believe that animals contemplate purposes to their existence. I do know that the human being has the capacity, we can think about purpose to existence, whether we find it or not is something else, but we can think about it. That's another unique human trait. Now that is very uniquely human. You see, animals are not free. Animals are slaves. Because an animal has no choice about whether it wants to do something or not. What happens if an animal becomes hungry? Well, it must go search for food. And if it becomes thirsty, it must go search for water. And if it becomes sexually aroused, it must go look for a mate. An animal has no choice in that. I mean, do you ever think that an animal has ever said, I'm so hungry today and I'm so thirsty, but I'm going to fast. An animal cannot say that. Hunger and thirst drive the animal to find resolutions, gratification for its drive. Nothing will stop an animal from that. Human being has the capacity to say, I have this feeling, I have this desire, I have this urge, but I have reasons why I'm not going to gratify it, for whatever reason. Now, it's not quite right what I said, that an animal cannot stop an urge. There are things that will stop an animal. But the only thing that will really stop an animal, other than being in a barricade or barrier, the only thing that will stop an animal from following an urge is a fear of punishment. For example, you have this little coyote, a little jackal, hasn't had a morsel of food, terribly hungry. So it's going around looking for something to eat, and it discovers a carcass. Ah, a simcha, it's got a carcass, right? It takes a look, there's a great big tiger standing over that carcass. Huge tiger, powerful. Well, you know that little jackal isn't going to go anywhere near that carcass. But it's hungry. Yeah, it doesn't want to get killed. You don't start up with a tiger, not if you're a jackal, you don't. So, what keeps the jackal from going after his desire of gratification of his drive? The fear of punishment. Oh. Well, then if the only thing that keeps me from doing something that I would like to do is fear of punishment, I'm really still functioning on an animal level. So suppose that I have the capacity, through computers, to be able to transfer a huge sum of money to my account and become wealthy. I know how to do that. I might get caught, though. You know, if somebody's real sharp, they're going to pick that up and they're going to trace it back to me. And then I can be imprisoned for computer theft. Can't take that chance. If that's what stops me, then it's a fear of punishment. Or some individual might think, have an urge to have an illicit affair, and then think, but if it were ever exposed, I'd lose my family, I'd lose my respect in the community, I'd be so, my reputation would be gone. Can't take that risk. What's stopping him? Fear of punishment. As long as you're operating on fear of punishment, you haven't graduated beyond the animal level yet. That's not uniquely human yet. When does it become uniquely human? When you have a situation where this is something that can never be exposed. And furthermore, even if something could be exposed, nobody really cares. There will be no sanctions, no repercussions, nobody will hold me back. But I don't think it is right. I refrain from this because I don't believe it's right. Now that is what an animal cannot do. An animal responds to fear of punishment, but cannot refrain from gratifying a desire on the basis of a principle of morality. So making a free moral choice is uniquely human. You know, I bring this point out in my daily work, when I work with addicts, to help them realize that when they are in addiction, they've lost part of their humanity because they've lost part of their freedom. It's very interesting to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and to hear an individual say, last month was 22 years since I had my last drink. Now I may drink today, but if I drink today, it's because I choose to drink. When I was in my active addiction, I had no choice. It's a very interesting concept, that addiction is when we lose choices. And whenever we lose choices, we become enslaved to something. It almost makes no difference what we are enslaved to. Being a human being, one of the characteristics, one of the unique features of a human being is being able to be free and to choose without fear of punishment. Now you notice that we've talked about several aspects, and maybe there are other things that are important, but we've just touched on a few. All of these things taken together comprise the uniqueness of a human being. And to the degree that we fulfill those, to that degree we become more perfect human beings. Then we become the idea of humanity that Hashem had in mind. To the degree that we're derelict in doing so, to that degree we lack in our humanity. And of course, if we lack in our humanity, we lack in self-esteem. A human being is not created perfect. Animals are. You know, an animal has nothing to do except grow. You get a little elephant, and what happens? Becomes a big elephant. Okay. And what happens with a little alligator? It eats and grows and becomes a big alligator, but it doesn't change. Now, I know that somebody's going to say, well, yes, there are animals that change. Caterpillars change into butterflies. Yes, true. How much say does the caterpillar have whether it wants to become a butterfly or not? Has none. Do you really think that it's ever happened that a caterpillar was crawling along the ground, looks up and sees this gorgeous butterfly, beautiful wings and multiple colors, and he says, well, will you look at that? That's my cousin George. Look at that snazzy outfit he's got with the wings and colors. Well, good for him. But I'm not going to do that, because I know me. I get up that high, I get airsick. So I'm not going into cocoon, and I'm not growing no wings, and I'm not becoming a butterfly. I'm staying a caterpillar right here on the ground, right where I feel comfortable. That doesn't happen. Why? Because programmed into the caterpillar's genes is that at a certain stage in its existence, it goes into a cocoon and comes out a butterfly, wants to or not. So you see, the changes that occur in animals, even if they do occur, are genetic changes programmed in, and they're not by choice. For you and I, that's different. We are capable of making changes that are not programmed into our genes, and we have the responsibility to make that change. We may make it, we may not make it. But if we do make those changes, then what do we become? To the degree that we make those changes and perfect ourselves, to that degree we become the human being that Hashem wanted us to be. Now think of it in this way. Animals are not free. Right? Neither are angels free. Because an angel is a shaliach. It's a message, a messenger, an emissary of God. God tells an angel, go do something. The angel goes and does it. The angels cannot go out and strike and say, we're not going to do things you say anymore. We want higher wages. Angels cannot defy an order. Right? Angels have no freedom. They're wonderful, they're holy, whatever, but they're not free. So as different than angels and animals are, neither of them are free. The only free being is a human being. And that's what we ought to pride ourselves on, is our freedom to choose, and not to lose that freedom to enslavement of any kind. Drugs, cigarettes, food, whatever. We should not be enslaved. And to the degree that we develop those unique features of human being and perfect ourselves, to that degree we become man. What happened after the first 5 days of creation was that Hashem said, created a lot of perfect beings. Created angels. They're complete when they're born. They're complete when they're created. They don't grow at all. They don't change. Right? Whatever the Malach Gabriel was when he was created, that's what he's like now. Angels don't grow in any way. Then Hashem said, I've created a lot of animals. They're also complete when they're born. They just have to grow in size or follow their program changes, but they don't change themselves, so they're complete when they're born. Now I want a different thing. I want a being that's not complete when he's born. I want to create an imperfect being. I want to create man, a human being. And Hashem says, now my definition of man is that it's a being that's created imperfect, who strives toward his or her own perfection. That's the concept, that's by definition, man. Now Hashem says, well, I could make him perfect, but that defeats the purpose. If I create another perfect being, what have I got? Either I got another angel or another animal. I don't want either more. Right? Got enough angels, got enough animals. Time for a unique being. A being that's going to be created imperfect and is going to become that which I want him to become. And then he becomes the idea of man. And in order to do that, Hashem had to create us imperfect and leave it to us to make ourselves perfect. Now I think it becomes very evident why Hashem is saying, let us make man. Who's the us who he's talking to? It's to us. He creates the form of Adam and he says, look here, Adam, I could create you perfect. Shucks. If I create you perfect, you'll be an angel or you'll be an animal. You'll be something like that. I'm going to create you imperfect, and you're supposed to work on your own perfection and become what I want you to become. And then you will be man. So you and I together, Adam, right, will make man. I'll give you the potential, I'll give you all the capabilities, and you're supposed to work and develop it. So let us make man, you and I together. I was very thrilled to have made that interpretation of let us make man. And even more thrilled to find out that it was true, because I later found out that the Baal Shem said it. And that this was his interpretation of "let us make man." That it's a challenge to ourselves that we become part of our own creation. And it, indeed, the Talmud says it. Many times when the Talmud talks about when a person behaves in the appropriate fashion, he becomes a partner to Hashem in the act of creation, because we actually become a partner. So it's our job then to make ourselves into what we can be. And this is the fulfillment of our self-esteem. Now there are many values that Torah has that are in sharp difference from the prevailing secular values. And it's important to realize this, because the world around us is an environment which is absolutely ridiculous and getting crazier every day. And we tend to be schlepped along with it. And that's why we constantly need to be reminded about Torah values. I mentioned to you before that a person who has good self-esteem does not have to go around boasting about how great he is. He knows he's okay. He doesn't need any external approval or reinforcement of it. He doesn't have to demonstrate his power. He doesn't have to manifest his wealth. He doesn't have to go fighting for COVID. You ever notice the tragic thing? I feel so sorry for people when I see them fighting in the shul for honors. Yeah. Just imagine I didn't get the first Hakof at Simchas Torah. That was a terrible embarrassment. Right? Somebody got a better aliyah than I did, and that's a put down to me. Right? Or, you know, you arrange a banquet or whatever, and you sit them at table 8 instead of table 6, and it's a wholesale disaster. Right? I wasn't given the proper recognition. Constantly needing that. I feel terribly sorry for people who operate on that wavelength. They think so poorly about themselves that they constantly have to be reinforced and be told, "You're okay, you're okay, you're okay, you're okay." Now, you know that the Torah values and the secular values differ so much. For example, if we were to ask a person on the street, "Well, how do you define a wealthy person?" Oh, they'll tell you, look at the list and published in the paper, the 10 wealthiest people in the United States. You know, multi-billions, multi-billions, multi-trillions, whatever it is. Right? What they have. Right? Torah doesn't say that. Eza Osher, who is a truly wealthy person? Hasameach Bechelka, one is satisfied with whatever he has. Right? So once asked J. Paul Getty, "What do you consider being wealthy?" And he answered, "To have just a little more." Yeah, but that's not the Torah attitude. The Torah attitude is wealth is what you have when you're satisfied with what you have. If you ask somebody, "Who's a powerful person?" They say, "Oh, a powerful person is somebody who commands such immense military forces that he could destroy the world, could do this, could conquer nations, whatever." Right? And the Talmud says, no. A powerful person is not someone who can be master over others. A powerful person is a person who can be master over himself. It's self-mastery. Mastery over others is a sign of weakness. Why do you have to dominate others? If you feel okay about yourself, why do you have to be in charge of other people? Anybody who fights for the power to be in charge of others is betraying how they feel about themselves. If I feel good enough about myself, I don't have to be boss over others. I work on my own self-mastery. Eza Mechubad, what's an honorable person? An honorable person is one who has a whole wall full of trophies and people are constantly honoring him. No way. That's terribly weak to have to show up. I've got a whole wall full of trophies. Look who I am, you know, the red string around the toe. Right? I've got this honor, I've got that honor, I've got that honor, I've got that testimonial. No way. The Torah value is, if you really feel good about yourself, then you're a person who can give others COVID instead of receiving it. Eza. A person who is truly honorable is one who can give honor, not receive it. These are Torah values, totally distinct from secular values. So secular values are right in keeping with a low self-esteem. And Torah values are in keeping with a very healthy self-esteem. As we said, animals can't think of a purpose in life. Human beings can. To the degree that we think about a purpose in life, we become a better human being. We are exercising one of our human faculties. To the degree that we learn from history and we look back on previous generations and we try to achieve their greatness, or look at others and things that have happened and learn from mistakes of others, not to repeat them, to that degree we're using our human capabilities. To the degree that we are free and make free moral choices, totally unrelated to fear of sanction and punishment, to that degree we are fine human beings. We are developing ourselves as humans. So to the degree that we use all of our capacities as humans and participate with Hashem in making ourselves, to that degree we enhance our self-esteem. To the degree that we go with secular ideas, to that degree we lose our self-esteem. Secular ideas are so absolutely mixed up. Pursuit of happiness, I agree. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, wonderful ideas. And I think that it's within human being to pursue happiness. We talked this afternoon about joy. There's a strong similarity between joy and happiness, and I think people should be happy. What means happiness? What is this happiness that everybody is searching for? We talked a little bit about today about how some people think that happiness is getting high with a chemical. Well, obviously, that's a perverse idea of happiness. Happiness might be to be free of all pressures, of all distresses, of all worries, then you're content. Oh, so then happiness is contentment. Well, I don't like the idea that happiness is contentment. I don't like it a single bit. I think it's degrading. Now, why do I think it's degrading? This idea occurred to me in 1955. I had just gone into medical school. And at that time, there was the first major pharmacologic breakthrough in the first tranquilizer that the pharmaceutical industry produced. Miltown came out in 1954, right? And it was the first happy pill. Nobody knew about that time how deadly addictive it was, right? So it was the first tranquilizer. It's going to make people feel okay. You know, I was going into med school and I was figuring that, you know, isn't it wonderful? I will have so much more to offer my patients than my predecessors did. The generation before me didn't have antibiotics. I'm going to have antibiotic treatment. The generation before me didn't have corticosteroids. I'm going to have corticosteroids. The generation before me didn't have miraculous surgical procedures. I'm going to be able to have to offer patients miraculous surgical procedures. Generations before me didn't have a good drug to give people for their discontent. I'm going to have tranquilizers. Look at what a wonderful time I'm going into. But I was thinking about this. And I'm pushing this cart down the aisle of the supermarket, thinking about how wonderful life is going to be for me. And as I'm pushing it, I come across the section where they're selling carnation milk. I stop there and I see a little poster, carnation milk. Our milk comes from contented cows. So I stopped there and I thought a minute, what's the ichus? Huh? Why is it important for me to know that their cows are contented? Because the sales pitch is quality milk, because it comes from the finest, highest quality cows. Why? Because our cows are contented. In other words, the ultimate in cowness, the ultimate in perfection in being a good cow is to be content. That's what the message is. Stop me a minute. Well, wait a second. Is that the goal that I'm after? What's the goal that I'm going to offer my patients? I'm going to give them a happy pill to make them content? Huh? And if contentment is all we're looking for, do we have any goal in life that's higher than the goal of a cow? I began to think and realized ultimately that happiness is not contentment. That a person should be able to be happy in spite of the fact that he is discontented. Now you're talking gibberish. That's double talk. It's not double talk. Happiness and discontent can go together. We talked about it this afternoon. We talked about how we grow and we realize our shortcomings and we realize how much more we have to do, and I'm discontented with where I am now, and that's why I'm going to do more. So discontent is a stimulus to growth. I want to be more than what I am now. I can make something more out of myself. I'm going to sit back and be contented. And if you take care of all my needs, I am going to be happy. Incidentally, many people have all their needs taken care of. And you should see how miserable people are who have all their needs taken care of. You know, somebody once said that there's an old saying, a Chinese curse. The Chinese curse is, may all of your fondest dreams come true. Why is that a curse? What are you going to do then? What's going to motivate you if all of your fondest dreams come true and you have nothing to strive for anymore? So just a little bit of thinking will make us realize that happiness is not synonymous with contentment. Now, secular world thinks it is. The drug world thinks it is. People take a heroin fix and they feel contented for an hour or so. That's not what we're after. We're after a positive happiness. And a positive happiness is the kind of simcha that Torah talks about. And sometimes we have a difficulty in identifying with that because we see that the simcha of Torah is not going to be, I'm going to give you everything that you want. But the simcha of Torah has to do with striving and growing and making more of out of ourselves. The Torah values, the concept of Torah living, and incidentally, we must not have a narrow view of Torah. Torah is the five books of Moses and the scriptures, yes. Torah is the Talmud, yes. Torah is the Rambam Maimonides, yes. Torah is Moshe Chaim Lutzatu and the Path of the Just, yes. Torah is the books of Chassidus and Musar, yes. Torah did not end with the revelation at Sinai. That's where it began. And it continues with the Torah works and the Torah authorities throughout all the ages until our present day. Some people will say, well, look, what are you talking about happiness? I mean, given the life circumstances that I have, there's just no way I can be happy. Look at the kind of things that have happened to me. And unfortunately, people are victims and have suffered variously from various vicissitudes, various kinds of things in life. And as difficult as that may be, and as distressful as that may be, that does not necessarily rule out happiness. All right, we talked about this afternoon about the importance of saying the Psalms, of saying Tillim. And over and above saying the words, to get a good translation and to read them and to study them. Because the majority of Tillim, the bulk of Tillim, was written by King David. The only person of whom we say in our entire history, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim. David Melech Yisrael, King David, lives eternally. I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu was great and all the prophets were great. And we don't go around saying that Moshe Chai V'Kayim. We don't say Avraham Avinu is Chai V'Kayim. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim. What's so unique about David HaMelech that he's achieved this universal existence with us? If you look at some of the phrases in Tillim, where David HaMelech says, Masata Simcha Belibi, you've given me Simcha in my heart. Simcha Tzadikim Hashem, let the righteous rejoice in Hashem. Where David HaMelech says, I will gladden and rejoice in you. Therefore my heart rejoices. Gladden the heart of your servant. David HaMelech knew what Simcha is. You'll also find Tillim full of complaints and of anguish and of cries for help. Let me tell you a little bit about David. David was the son of Jesse, David ben Yishai. The fascinating Medrash. Medrash says that Yishai, as we know, was a descendant of Rus. Right? Descendant of Rus. Rus was a Moabite. Right? If you look in Deuteronomy, remember it in Devarim, I think it's chapter 23, 24, somewhere around there, there's a verse that says that you're not allowed to accept a convert from Moav. Somebody comes from the people of Moav and wants to convert to Judaism, they're not allowed to be accepted. They're not allowed to marry within the Jewish nation. They're allowed to marry a convert, but they're not allowed to marry somebody of Jewish descent. And that when Yisha became aware of this, he felt that he had no right to stay married to his wife, because she was of legitimate Jewish descent, and here he was, a descendant of Ruth. Now what happened at that time was there was a controversy where some had said that the restriction applies only to the males of Moav, but not to the females. And that was the ultimate ruling. That inasmuch as Ruth was a female Moabite, the restriction did not apply to her, therefore Yisha was legitimate. And he was permitted to marry into the Jewish nation. But Yisha was uncertain that this was the ruling because some people said he wasn't, and so there was a great deal of controversy about it. And Yisha decided, in order for him to be certain that he is not violating a Torah prescription, he separated himself from his wife. By that time they had 5 children. Right? And he made the decision to separate from her. When he decided that he wanted to marry, and he could not marry a Jewish woman, he emancipated one of his maidservants, who was non-Jewish, and thereby she converted by emancipation, and he was going to marry her. And he did go through the marriage ceremony, and Yishai's real wife made a substitution, just as Lavan did with Leah and Rachel, and she bribed this maidservant, and she took her place that night. And that night she conceived of David. She conceived of David that night. Yishai had never picked up the substitution, was not aware of it. And later on, when he found that his wife, his first wife, whom he had separated from but had not divorced, that she was pregnant, he came to the conclusion she had had an adulterous affair and she was carrying an illegitimate child, a mamzer. The rest of the family were furious and they wanted to execute her for adultery. But somehow or other, it was never achieved and she had David. And when David was born, he was considered to be a mamzer. And he was not allowed into the household as a legitimate child. So he was given all of the dirty tasks of cleaning the animals and doing all the kinds of things out in the garbage or whatever, as you do to an outcast. And that continued until he was 23. What happened at age 23 was that Hashem sent the prophet Samuel to anoint one of Yishai's children as the next king of Israel. And when Yishai brought all of his sons before Shmuel, and Shmuel thought, oh, perhaps this one. And Hashem said, no, not this one. And I went through all of the children. Hashem said, this is not he, this is not the one, this is not the one. And after they were exhausted, Shmuel said to Yishai, don't you have any other children? And Yishai said, well, there is another one in the family, but he's not mine because he's a mamzer. And Yishai said, Shmuel said, let me see him. And then when Yishai brought David before him, Hashem revealed to Shmuel, this is the one, and Hashem revealed to Shmuel the secret of David's birth, which then Shmuel shared with Yishai. So at age 23, David's legitimacy was for the first time recognized, and for the first 23 years of his life, he was an outcast, a totally rejected in the family. Now that should give someone some pretty lousy self-esteem. Right? Well, it was shortly after this. You remember the story in the scriptures? That he was sent to the front where the Philistines were attacking the Bnei Yisrael, the Israelites. And then there was the confrontation with Goliath, where David slew Goliath. And he had his moment of greatness because King Saul took David into the royal court. And he became a favorite of King Saul for a very short period of time. Because then Saul was possessed by a very evil spirit and became terribly depressed and paranoid and began to pursue David and try to kill him. And David was on the run, constantly persecuted by Saul, running for his life. Very interesting chapter of the scriptures if you haven't read it. Look it up in the book of Samuel. And so David was fleeing for his life. And then finally, when there was another war with the Philistines and Saul was killed and David was anointed as king, Saul's family protested. And many people, including the leading scholars of the time, said that David has no right being king, because even if he is not illegitimate, he is a descendant of Ruth, and they took the position that all descendants of Moabite, male or female, are not permitted to be accepted. Therefore, David is of faulty lineage and he cannot become king. And they never let him forget it. And David was constantly tormented, both by Saul's family and by the scholars who believed that he had no right to the kingship. But when David finally settled into the kingship, he began having troubles from every part. What a terrible disaster, where one of his sons had an incestuous relationship with a half-sister. And then one of the brother of the half-sister killed the other brother. That's one of the troubles that he went through. And then David had the episode with Bathsheba, for which he never forgave himself. The Talmud says that for years David fasted and flagellated himself and wept day and night for his transgression with Bathsheba. And then his son Absalom got up and rebelled against him and was going to kill him. And David had to flee. And when David fled from Jerusalem, he told his generals, "Yes, you have to put down the rebellion, but spare my child." As rebellious and as defiant as Absalom was, he was still a child. And when the rebellion was finally quelled with the death of Absalom, David mourned unconsolably. 7 times he said, "My son, my son, my son, my son," and David could not be consoled. Well, you have just a life of suffering after suffering after suffering after suffering, till age 23 being an outcast, and after that just one misery, adversity after another. And what happens after that? What happens after that is he writes the Tillim. And in writing the Tillim, he says that he expects the Spirit of God to come back to him. "Grant me the Spirit, create a new heart within me. Show me the joy of your presence. Gladden the heart of your servant." Now, David was a very humble person. Somebody pointed out to me today in Shul, when we talked about self-esteem, he pointed out to me how David says, "But I am a worm, hardly a man." And David talks many times about my impoverishment. And constantly, and constantly talks about his shortcomings. And yet, the same David said, "God said to me, 'You are my child. Ask of me and I will make nations your inheritance.'" And David said, "God rewards me for my righteousness, for I have observed the ways of God. Protect me, God, for I am pious." And then in the great magnum opus, chapter 119, in every phrase, David talks about his observance of Torah. So here we have an individual who is truly humble, and yet his humility does not take away one iota from his greatness. An individual who has suffered more than perhaps any other being on earth has suffered, and yet comes up with a very strong positive feeling about himself and can be king over a nation and build a nation for 40 years. And I think that this is the reason why the Talmud wanted us to set David as an example for ourselves. And although we have had many, many, many great tzaddikim and many great leaders, it is only of David that we say, "David Melch Yisrael Chai V'Kayim." That spirit is an eternal one. That spirit is something that we should never lose. And if David could find happiness
in spite of his adversity, in spite of the horrendous things that happened to him, right, other people should be able to learn from that example and be able to find happiness in spite of adversity. Because happiness is not contentment. Contentment is for cows, and happiness is for people. So I sort of have the idea that when Hashem said, "Let us make man," he was talking to Adam. Adam, you and I are going to make man. And Adam tried. He did a halfway good job. And many people after him tried. And they did some fine job. But the ultimate in fulfilling "Let us make man" was David. Because David finally took the potential which God had given him and found happiness even in spite of horrendous adversity, found greatness in spite of his humility, and found a true self-esteem. This is why I think Tillim is so comforting. This is why we say Tillim at every occasion. It's in our daily services. And at times when we are cheered, we say Tillim in gratitude. And at times when we are, God forbid, in distress, we say Tillim for comfort. An excellent key to self-esteem. So, let me just wrap up, because it is getting late, and say that we couldn't go through all the manifestations of low self-esteem, but believe me, there are myriads. And we didn't begin to go through the causes of self-esteem, because that would have taken us another 3 hours. But there are many causes, many of which are totally beyond our control. There are many manifestations. But there is also a solution. I think that if we begin to approach Torah study, we begin to approach sincere prayer, then we begin to develop a way towards self-esteem. Is it something that we're going to accomplish in 24 hours? No way. Microwaves are for sandwiches. Microwaves are for leftovers. You can do that in a matter of seconds or minutes. There is no microwave, no comparable instrument for developing self-esteem. Takes hard work, takes time, takes patience, enormous amount of patience. But ultimately, it's a wonderful feeling. It's a feeling that will enrich us, and a feeling that we can, by contagion, pass on to our children. If someone asked me today, what can we do to develop self-esteem in our children? And my answer is, let it spread from yourself. Self-esteem is contagious. Parents who have a good self-image infect their children with a good self-image. And parents who have a poor self-esteem pass over to their children feelings of low self-confidence and insecurity. So utilize the Torah. It's yours. It's a gift of Hashem to help us become partners with Him in creation to achieve the ultimate of creation, which is the creation of man, because you and God together can create yourself. Thank you for listening. 35 minutes. Okay.